You are now listening to Postmortem with Mick Garris, where the most influential voices in horror cinema will spill their guts, literally, to the renowned horror director, writer, and producer. Now, here's your host, Mick Garris.
I'm Mick Garris, and from Nice Guy Productions, world headquarters overlooking the glamorous San Fernando Valley, this is Postmortem. Just as there are societal classes in life, the same is true in movies. At one end of the spectrum are the major studio behemoths, Marvel franchise movies that cost hundreds of millions of dollars and gross in the billions. There are the theatrical indie companies that find great success in cinemas with international and more modest budgets and themes, companies like Searchlight, which is a part of 20th Century Fox, Blumhouse, part of Universal, and Focus, also part of Universal. Then there are the true independents that are unaffiliated with the big guys, Bleecker Street, A24, IFC, Neon, and Music Box, all of whom have been able to get their movies onto the big screens with a great deal of success. Even Netflix and Amazon have found homes in cinemas with a select few of their movies. Then come the films that go direct to video on demand, or get sold directly to Amazon or Netflix or Hulu, often to disappear without a trace. How do you find the good ones? How do you shine a spotlight on them? Could it be that the era of the truly independent theatrical features, especially in the horror genre, could be at an end? In the 1970s, it was easy to find alternative fare in the downtown movie houses, grindhouses or otherwise, and the ubiquitous drive-ins. Well, the grindhouses are gone now, either razed to the ground, turned into churches, or, if you're lucky, maintained as concert and live theater venues. And the same goes for the drive-in. Truly independent movies are clinging to life by their fingernails. The avenues of distribution have been appropriated by the big boys. The multiplexes play one Marvel movie on 8 of their 12 screens. When marketing costs run into the very high millions to distribute a single film, how can a movie with a $1 million budget, without movie stars or high-end visual effects spectacles, compete? Unfortunately, the answer is that they can't. Oh, there are the occasional gems that break through and make a mark, like The Witch, Hereditary, Tigers Are Not Afraid, handful of others. But they are the exceptions that prove the rule. Lloyd Kaufman is the definition of independent filmmaker. He has weathered the tides of change in film creation and distribution, and his Troma Films company is still here despite the battering of an indifferent industry. We'll talk with him about his victories and challenges after this. It's 2020, and surfing the web is dead. All the horror news you need is now just one click away. Fangoria.com is your first destination for all the horror news of the day, featuring a constant curation of the Fango team's favorite links from across the internet. You'll also find deep dives and daily thoughts from the biggest names in horror, as well as exclusive access to the Fangoria Vault. Check out Fangoria.com for yourself and see the horror right before your eyes. Use promo code POSTMORTEM for 15% off right now. So, Lloyd, where did it start for you? Was your family interested in the arts?
My mother was a theater person. And we subscribed Mondays to opera, and I went to a lot of Broadway shows.
And you were raised in New York.
Yes, raised in New York. We had a lot of theater people in our home, some of them stars. I was obsessed with musicals. I had no thought of going into any form of show business. I was into something else. So... it wasn't until I went to Yale that I happened to be stuck in a room with a movie nut my freshman year, and he ran the Yale Film Society, and our beds were head to toe at night, very small bedroom, and I would inhale his Godel stinking feet, and eventually the aroma du Troma wafted for now it's 50 years I've been making feature-length movies.
So it beckoned. But there were never thoughts of going into theatrical performance or creation of that sort?
No. Oddly enough, there's a Toxic Avenger musical that has been very successful.
Uh-huh.
And it played in New York for a year. And I'm looking into, I have the authors, in fact, it was written by Bon Jovi's David Bryan and Joe DiPietro. Both of them are Tony Award winners.
Wow.
And it's very good. And it only has five actors. And it's hilarious. And the music, you go out singing and dancing, and it's funny as hell. And so I'm looking, starting to look for off Broadway, maybe make a tiny little production and see if I can, you know, the director of the creator of The Toxic Avenger is going to direct a show, a theatrical musical in New York City. So if I can put it together, that might be an interesting event.
It'll come full circle to your infatuation with musicals, right?
Yeah. I think I know a lot about musicals, being a gay married man, having wept through every Judy Garland, Barbara Streisand musical. I think I can handle it.
Your qualifications are intact.
I think so. And Poultrygeist, Night of the Chicken Dead, which was recently in an editorial, of course, in one of your major papers, is a kind of a musical. It's not a classical musical.
It is like, not a classical musical.
You know, it's not the way Trey Parker's Cannibal the Musical, which is a trauma movie.
A trauma film.
That's
yeah.
like Oklahoma. Ours is more irregular, like my bowels. The songs don't come when they're supposed to come, you know.
Let's go back to that beginning, because
in fact, I'm glad you got some kind of tablecloth on your couch here, because
I've got
we don't want to cut
furniture.
You know, speaking of irregular bowels, I'm 73 now.
Oh my God, we're in trouble.
Trauma is the 45th year of trauma, by the
which
way,
which is amazing.
It's a miracle
for any independent
it's a
company.
Miracle.
Yeah, that's right. Miracle Productions.
It really
if it's
is.
If it's a classic film, it's a miracle.
When you think about the kind of movies we've made,
exactly.
And Michael Herz is basically the CEO. He's managed to make us profitable for, you know, with no debt for 45 years. And with movies like, you know, Bloodsucking Freaks and Surf Nazis Must Die. And
Sergeant Kabuki Man.
And the new one is called Hashtag Shakespeare's Shitstorm.
And so, you're directing this one, right?
I've directed about 30 of them.
Yeah.
Usually if I direct a movie, it'll go into a couple of hundred theaters. Not all at once, but one by one by one by one. And you met Lemley out here in Los Angeles, very nice to us. The Alamo chain.
Alamo
but we
Draft
don't.
House, yeah.
Lemley gives us a couple of weeks if we do okay. We get a week and then we can get held over. Alamo, it's usually a weekend if we're lucky, or you know, maybe a week if they really.
Well, we went through that with Nightmare Cinema. You know, we got basically a week or a weekend in one theater in a handful of cities, and it's challenging.
Oh
now.
Well, you had stars. You had a major.
Well, we
just
did.
That opening. The opening movie was should have gotten you Cinerama or whatever.
Well,
it's called.
It should. Yes, but well. But
it's a great movie. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you so much.
Great themes.
I appreciate it. You know, it's great to be able to get a group of talented filmmakers and cut them loose on letting them do whatever they want to
yes.
do.
Yes. Yeah.
And
yeah.
that's great. Well, and that's your history. You've always been on the outside. And it's worked for you really well. It's also been challenging as the industry has changed. But how did Trauma come together? I mean, I know the first film you ever made, I believe, was a short that you did when you were in Africa, and it was shooting a pig being killed.
Yes, I took a year off from Yale and went to what I wanted to be Africa of the movies. I wanted to devote my college career to learning about China and Africa, because I went to a very strict all boys Latin school, and it was all about Europe and the United States, and they hardly ever mentioned. I mean, you know, I graduated from high school in 64, so, you know.
Before the Enlightenment.
Yeah, before, yes. You said it. And so I decided I'd go and live in the bush of Chad, and we had our own animals, and, you know, we didn't have running water. We had a lot of naked non-males running around or whatever.
Right.
I don't know what the political. We call them gyno-Africans because that's apparently what NPR wants you to say.
Oh, okay.
So I don't know what's. That was a while back. It was when I was.
And what was the purpose of that trip to Africa?
Well, I was there basically because I hate to keep talking about myself, but I blew a fuse.
That's
I think.
Why we're here.
I grew up in Manhattan, a block of cement, and then all boys for 13 years at Trinity School. Then Yale was all boys, and strict, and you know what, you know, just constant grinding and And I figured, what the, I gotta cool off.
You needed a relief valve.
Some kind of a, yeah, I blew a fuse, I think. So yeah. I went to Chad. I lived in the bush. No telephones, no electricity, no running water.
You did it just to get away or to study?
I did it to get away, but also there was a subsidiary benefit, which I didn't really do it for, but it kept me out of Vietnam, getting my ass shot off in a stupid fucking bullshit war. There was no way I was going to join up.
Right.
And it gave me another year because I was allegedly in dangerous area, a lot of disease. And there wasn't fighting like now. Like, you couldn't go to Chad now. You couldn't even go in the country. But then I could sleep on the out in the road. I slept on the side of the road, no problem. And there were, you know, animals and all that kind of stuff. But I was working basically as a pathfinder for the Peace Corps. They needed people to test the area to see what the diseases would be, what were the political issues. Where I was were different races living, like six different types of African.
So you were a volunteer with the Peace Corps, which was President
Kennedy's. Well, I wasn't.
Kennedy's
no, I was AID. I was brought in by AID, but I was actually working for the Chadian government, teaching English in a Collège d'Enseignement Général. Being very bourgeois, I learned French as a child, so you know, I could speak French. But I was teaching them English, which was absolutely useless to the people in which I was in contact, because they didn't even know Kennedy had been assassinated. You know, it was really it was totally cut off. It was, but it was Africa as Africa. I mean, it was beautiful.
So
everybody was healthy.
Expanding.
Pardon?
It had to be mind.
Oh my
expanding.
God! Absolutely.
So
I mean, talk about a cultural anthropology. I had never taken an anthropology course. I knew the only thing I knew about Africa was from John Ford movies. You know, that kind of stuff, and of course, African Queen.
Right, John Huston.
John Huston. Yeah. And you know, their concept of time, I saw, totally different from ours. Big is valuable. Doesn't really matter, you know, if it's an artistic piece that might have taken you a week to carve. Mm-hmm. A big one is, you know, more.
That's more momentous.
It was and it was the different villages. There were different chiefs, and it was an interesting area where I was in. But they all had very sophisticated interpersonal relationships and verbal community, you know, stories, and you know, it wasn't, you know, and I kind of got all this before I learned it from Levi Strauss or any of the anthropologists. I saw it up front and personal, and it really was interesting. And it also, in retrospect, you see how sad the situation is in Africa.
So what kind of interpersonal relationships did you have there? You weren't just dealing with people from the Peace Corps side or the AID
side. No, there
side,
were very few.
But you had friendships.
There were no Peace Corps. There were no Peace Corps whatsoever. Right. Although, based on my, I got all sorts of interesting diseases. I got malaria, a mild form of malaria. I got dengue fever. I got every kind of social disease. I mean, I had eyeballs on my penis. I mean, you cannot imagine what I got.
And the
but
view.
But that was not the, you know, I'm sure the Peace Corps. The thing is, I was able to, I had absolutely no preparation to go there.
What did you study at Yale?
My major ended up as Chinese studies because I wanted to, you know, learn about China and Asia.
And I know you are fluent in French and Chinese.
Well, I'm fluent in French. Chinese, I was pretty good, but I've lost it.
Well, your work is so international, but I'm curious about what led to you first picking up a film camera and deciding to take pieces of film and putting it into a narrative.
Well,
this was while you were in Africa.
Well, actually, before I went, my roommate was obsessed with the auteur theory of cinema, and that's what they programmed at the Yale Film Society. So I'd go in there, seeing if I could hook up with a young.
So, did you think of becoming a filmmaker while you were at Yale?
No. Oh yeah, yes. By the time I got back from Africa, I had pretty much decided. I think I'm gonna. And I bought a 16mm camera and brought a load of film there filmed some various. I got a lot of good anthropological stuff, which I think Yale has, actually.
So,
I think I gave it to my professor.
So when you went to Africa to Chad, did you take a camera with you, or was
yes.
it so you wanted to do sociological filmmaking? And
well, I didn't know. I just it was
you just wanted to record something.
Well, it was, you know, it looked like the where I was, there were people dancing in circles with big sticks, and there was another village where they were wearing weird things and masks, Toxic Avenger masks.
Right.
We had tons of naked ladies everywhere, naked Gyno-Africans. And so that might have put the seed into my, you know, I got laid in France once, thanks to Oliver Stone. Well, we paid for it. Yeah, I grew up with him. His mother was French, actually. And so I spent a lot of summers in France. But I think we went to Les Halles. In those days, the Pompidou Center was basically the horror central for Paris.
Right,
so
right.
Oliver took me there. And then at the in the morning, you'd have like oysters or some kind of stuff afterwards. But Chad was basically my breaking virginity kind of thing.
Right, interesting.
Yeah,
so
I was totally irresponsible. But I didn't get kicked out. The Peace Corps was there and got kicked out. I did everything wrong. I didn't get kicked out. The only thing that happened to me was I was living with three French guys in a sort of a cement block. Didn't have screens, didn't have water or anything. But it was a bit away from the area, the town area. But I moved into the town, and this guy who ran a general store, I can't remember what race he was, or tribe, whatever you call him, he gave me a house. So I had this young lady with me, very beautiful, very nice. And I had a great time. And then the Catholic priest from the, what do you call it? Monastery, you know, they're trying to convert people.
Oh, yes.
Whatever they call those things. He came over to where I was staying with the French guys, and he said, I'm going to tell the American ambassador that you've been fucking around with the whatever. And the American ambassador was very nice to me. And so I didn't want, you know, I was like, how many Americans came through Chad? You know, I was like one
of
three.
Right.
So I didn't want to cause him any trouble. He was a really good guy. And he would send us boxes of things that you couldn't get jam, for example. You couldn't get anything like that. So he would send stuff to us. And and he also shipped stuff for me. I mean, they were very nice.
So this was an incredibly inspiring cultural exploration
there. Well, I had to leave my house in the village with my beautiful Ashatu and then go back with the French dudes. Because the priest was threatening, and I didn't want to. You know, if it was today, I would have told him to go screw himself. But and especially now, every time I look at a priest, I have to look at. You know, I can't even. The first thing that comes to my head is, you know what? Right,
yeah.
It's a whole different world now. I would have.
It is a different world.
God knows what that guy was doing. You know, who knows.
And you're 18, 20 years
old
at the time,
18,
something
yes,
like
18.
That. Yeah, so exploring this.
Totally immature.
But you made your first film there, a short film.
Well, the Killing the Pig, yeah.
Right.
And
was that all about? And it had a real effect on you in your filmmaking philosophy,
well,
it seems.
I don't know.
But I mean,
well,
by
you know, I'm a very strong animal rights person, and that was, you know,
I'm a vegan myself.
I'm not as heroic as you, but I'm vegetarian. I don't eat other than human flesh. I eat no flesh, then I, you know, we raised this pig. We had to eat. The guy slit its throat, hung it upside. You know, it was sort of a little documentary. But the fun was to. You know, I cut it together.
So to speak.
And then show it to my bourgeois mother and her friends with their martinis. And they would go, you know, it was the excitement of just seeing how pissed off they were and how disgusted they were was definitely. And I'm pretty good. I think I've developed the pissing people off.
and disgusting.
Very, very expertly. Over
but
the
it does
50.
Seem to have been a recurring theme in what trauma has been all about is like this galvanizing, shocking elements that, oh, look how I can manipulate an audience by breaking the rules and shocking them.
Well, certainly The Toxic Avenger was the first movie with a full head-crushing scene.
There you go.
As far as I know, of course, now Spielberg and Terrence Malick, they're all doing it. But the Toxic Avenger was the only movie with a full head-crushing scene that was made into a environmentally correct children's Saturday morning cartoon show.
There you go.
The Toxic Crusaders. Which we still own, and we are still, it's on our Troma Now streaming service, and people love it. It was on Fox for a couple of years, and quite a good show.
Let's go back to the roots of Troma and how it actually happened. Troma, you were making your own movies, but you're also acquiring other people's movies. But how did it start in the very beginning?
We were, Michael Herz and I were wanting to make movies without being told what to do. And I was working.
You have a rebellious streak, don't you?
Yeah, and I regret a lot of it, too. Yeah, I regret, you know, Edith Piaf was very wrong with her Je ne regrette rien. Je regrette beaucoup. I regret plenty. Boy. The thing was, we just didn't want to be told what to do, and it seemed logically, hey, you make, you know, when you're 19, 20, 21, whatever, anything's possible, you know. Oliver and I grew up together, and he went to Vietnam the year I went to. He volunteered to go fight in Vietnam as an infantry guy.
Right, leading to platoon later.
The year and he got wounded too. And he's a genuine hero. He was a genuine hero. I saw the certificate. He rescued people from a tank bomb or something. I don't know, but and he was off. Vietnam turned him around. You know.
Right.
Africa certainly left its mark on me, but Vietnam really left its mark because he was right wing
it seems the more you're exposed.
He would have been voting for your buddy Trump here.
Not my buddy. Not,
well, you know what I mean. You know,
but no, but it not seems anymore, like the more international experience people have, the more progressive their politics.
Well, I think there's some truth to that. Yeah, although Mr. Stone's been kissing Putin's ass. Boy, that documentary, holy Christ.
Yeah.
You know, it's the other side of it. You know, it's, again, it's kind of yin and yang, you know.
Right, falling. So, the beginnings of Troma, the first film.
Yeah, we made three movies. And, I go to Yale, you meet rich kids. I have dentists, they're rich. So we raise money. We made sugar cookies with Mary Warrenov and... And thanks to Oliver, he insisted, he wanted to have smart him. We put in Monique Van Vooren, who was kind of a half star. And I had hung out with Warhol, so I was able to get some of those Warhol, Ondine and one or two others. And we got nothing back. It's a good film. In fact,
right.
When it came out.
So you were around the factory at that time.
Yeah, right? I hung out when I was at Yale. I used to hang out at Max's and in the factory, too, with my little bar mitzvah suit. You know, we always we had to
Warhol.
Wear ties and jackets, right?
Wow.
We literally grew up with that stuff. So, I was just watching. You know, I wasn't
right.
Really.
You weren't a participant?
Well, I wasn't, I was goody-goody. It was later that I got into good
stuff.
But
Sugar Cookies was your first.
Yeah, it was a remake of Vertigo, but with lesbians. And it's very good.
No.
The mistake is, and I regret it, is I should have directed it. Mm. But there were older guys involved, and I unfortunately listened to them. But
you think people with experience know more than you do, and then you learn.
Yeah, I raised all the money from my friends and dentists. Yeah. And you can't imagine how many teeth I had to have pulled just to raise the money for that movie.
I can't imagine. So that was the first one.
Yeah, and we didn't make any money. It was an X-rated movie. Can you imagine the first X-rated movie and probably the only one in history that lost,
didn't make
lost money?
Yeah.
And we were so sure, this is definitely going to make money. We had these two older guys. And it wasn't Troma in those days. It was a company called Armor.
Right,
and
right.
And then Menachem Golan came along. I got a great deal. All you got to do is you put up the money. We do everything else. The services. Everybody in Israel sees every movie six times. We make an Israeli negative and an American negative, and blah blah blah. So Andy Lack, my childhood kid, who was luckily untouched by the sugar cookies failure, he came in to produce. Andy Lack is now running NBC News and having lots of fun with it.
I've seen
in the hashtag Me Too world.
That's for sure.
But we wrote a script. Pardon?
Matt who?
Yeah. Exactly. Bathrobe one. Anyway, we wrote a good script together. Andy liked it. We wrote it, and then the Israeli guys went off to set it up. And when we got there, it had all changed. They changed the whole thing around to suit the what they thought would suit the Israeli market, because there's this two negatives: the Israeli one where you break even, the Hebrew version, and then the English version. That's where the gravy is.
Right.
So anyway, we made the worst movie ever made, called Big Gus, What's the Fuss?
And,
how
and
stupid,
no
again, listening to older people. If there are any young people out there, don't even listen to me if you're out there. In fact, you should definitely not listen to me.
Yeah,
business model is not really the, suggested one.
But your business model was, and the only thing you can do as an independent is you don't have money for stars. You have limited resources. What has proven to be the most reliable, profitable way to make independent movies is sex and violence. Did you find that to be the case? Because Troma represented first a lot of stuck on you and a lot of
You're right. That's a very good point. We got into we got lucky. We made a movie called, all the movies that I personally have been involved in have political and sociological themes. And that may be one of the reasons that we've had a pretty good take up on them. But we made a movie about the in 76 about the that was based on the Equal Rights Amendment kind of thing, called Squeeze Play, about a women's softball team, 15 years before the much inferior League of Their Own came out. And Squeeze Play combined sex, which you weren't supposed to combine sex and comedy. Right. The sex was like a serious thing for to enhance the raincoat manufacturing. So we made this goofy, raunchy R-rated. Well, it was R-rated. And the MPAA totally fucked us on the rating. They were the scum of the earth. But luckily, we put a lot of the stuff back in after we got the R rating. And
So you and Roger Corman used the same playbook in that.
Well, actually, I learned that from Lee Hessel, who... taught me a lot about producing, and we did Cry Uncle. I helped him produce Cry Uncle, which Troma is still distributing, directed by the great John G. Avildsen.
The director of Rocky.
A much underrated, Cry Uncle, a much underrated
it's good
film by a very underrated director.
Yeah.
Ian Romero, I think, and Mick Garris, of course. the three course. Treasures that I think do not get a fair deal.
I've had a fair enough deal. It's all good. So again, let's talk about the sex and violence, or sex and horror.
Yes. Well, the point
your
is,
approach to sex was playful for the first
time.
Well,
the point is, if you do something different, it might work. And we got in ahead of Porky's, and we got four movies that made a lot of... Well, not, we actually distributed some, too.
Mm-hmm.
But the ones we actually directed... And in those days, Michael Herz and I were... Well, I guess, from Waitress on, we were doing them all together, directing together. And it was great. And then Michael Herz became an adult and decided to to try to make a success out of Troma, and he became the CEO, and I attended to the so-called...
The creative aspects.
The art.
Yes,
the art of the Troma.
By
the way, there's a beautiful book that's come out, The Art of Troma. A coffee table book.
Is
two
art
versions.
In quotes?
No, it's a serious... Well, it's a beautiful book. Lots of
good.
Posters. You know, they're literally the art of Troma.
Right.
But there's a two versions: the deluxe version, of which there are only 1,000, and then I guess however many thousands the other version. It's very nicely done. Diamond, whatever.
Publishing.
Yeah. No, not Dynamite. Sorry,
Dynamite Publishing.
Dynamite. Okay. Very good job.
Well, sex, violence, horror. It's also about taboos. You have one of the strengths of Troma is there are no taboos. I think Poultrygeist may be the shining example of breaking every taboo of a commercial movie there is.
It's so interesting, though, that, I mean, we're not the only ones. The problem is there are a lot of young people who think that that's all there is to it.
Right.
You get a few women, you run them through the forest, you lop their heads off and throw blood and you make money. But it doesn't. You have to have something that's at least it's got to be entertaining.
Right.
And you got to get the one thing Rupert Murdoch doesn't have, and the one thing that the that the elites don't have is the mega conglomerates don't have is word of mouth. They can't buy it.
Right.
I just saw it with Slim and Queen. I ran to see it first night. My wife, too. It sounded great. The New York Times ejaculated over it every day of the week.
Yeah.
And it sounded great. And it looked, and the actors are terrific. The theater was empty.
Yeah.
And New York City.
Yeah.
But the public found out day one that it's a lazy writing. Next door is the Knives Out.
Knives Out.
Right,
yeah,
which
yeah.
sounds like a crappy Agatha Christie Strangers on the the thing on the train
with
all the stars, the mega stars. Orient Express.
Murder on the Orient.
But it turns out it's directed by Rian Johnson.
Right.
It's a really good movie. And the place was packed. And I told my wife, I want to sneak in. Let's go after Slim and Queen. Let's go go next door and see the knife thing. But she doesn't. That's dishonest. You know? And she's a New York State Film Commissioner, retired. So
That's
she was
fair
20
enough.
Years New York State Film Commissioner. So she.
What do you want
her,
when you go to see a movie? What are you looking for? What are the things that excite you when you go to the movies?
The director.
Yeah.
It's all in my book. It's the director, and I know writers are very underrated, underpaid, and underrated, Preston Sturges, one of my heroes, was a writer.
The first writer-director in Hollywood. Yeah.
Sorry?
The first writer-director in Hollywood.
Yes. And five smashes in a row, and they still destroyed him.
Yep.
Right? His biography.
Between
the flops.
Right? Between the flops, one. Preston Sturges.
It's amazing. Yeah. And
one of the most important writer-directors ever. Yeah.
They brought him down, right?
Completely.
Yeah.
Howard Hughes bought his contract and then basically ruined his professional life. Well, how do you see yourself in the filmmaking world? There's no question that you're a maverick. You're an independent with a company that's been going for 45 years, which is almost unheard of. So how do you see yourself in this constantly state of flux world of filmmaking?
I say, fuck the flux. That's a line from The First Turn-On, which is Vincent D'Onofrio's first movie.
Ah.
And I would say The First Turn-On is our funniest movie. And it's also the one that Michael Herz had the most of his soul
input.
Into. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it is his and his wife's story to some extent. But that was a fuck the flux.
Right.
That was
what is your philosophy as a filmmaker? I mean, there's a lot of politics in even the most grotesque elements of your films. There's always some social consciousness injected in it.
Yes. I had a very socialist grandmother who instilled in me a very anti-Nixon philosophy. To her, Castro was a hero. He kicked out the whores and the croupier. She gave me a book when I was a child called Brave New World.
It
wasn't the one you're thinking
of.
It was about China.
Oh.
And at Christmas, you know, other kids would get a new bicycle. I'd get a book from International Publishers, which was a communist publishing house.
Mm.
But, it would be by Scott Nearing or Carlos Lamont. You know, there were all these older socialists still going, you know, had been blacklisted. And so I got a heavy dose of that from my grandmother.
Of lefty politics.
And
it remains.
It definitely remains.
Yeah.
You bet. But it also, there's a lot of goofy stuff going on the far left that makes no sense either. But I think the advice I would give to young people who are starting out is twofold. One, to thine own self be true, which, as you know, is a phrase coined by one William Shakespeare, who wrote 101 best-selling screenplay ideas, otherwise known as Hamlet. And to thine own self be true, I think that works pretty well. And
have you been true to your own vision as a filmmaker or as a film distributor?
I think as a film distributor, it's basically all about filleting the fucking people I have to talk to, groveling. Hers doesn't do that. I'm the one that goes to do that.
Right.
And I'm not bad at it, but it doesn't really. You have to have a film that's entertaining, and it's still the story. It's still the entertainment. Our movies, we made the Troma's War. made in 1986, people are still booking it into theaters. One night, midnight show.
Right,
Romeo
sure.
and Juliet by James Gunn, written by James Gunn, which I directed in 94, is still being booked into theaters. And Museum of Modern Art, Romeo and Juliet. In fact, Return to Newcomb High, which is a two-part movie. Volume
right.
one was premiered at the Museum of Modern Art in New York, and Volume 2 at the Museum of the Moving Image, last year. So here
Fantastic.
Are movies that are in museums that are new, brand new. But on the other hand, I would suggest that we're not exactly rich. It's a different world.
Well, let's talk about how that world is different. You've now created a streaming channel, a trauma streaming channel that's available now. How difficult is it in getting your movies booked into theaters, or do you even bother with the theatrical these days? Do you go direct to a video on demand, or do you make deals with the streaming companies like Netflix and Amazon? What is your business model these days?
Well, it's pretty much the same. It's always been to do what's in your heart, make your own damn movies. And I've written 7 books all about
yeah.
that. 2 of them are novels, but the rest are all instructive, supposedly. In my head, they're instructive. They're very funny if you want to be entertained.
Oh, I've read a couple of them. One of them.
Thank you. Yeah. And make your own damn movie. Direct your own damn movie, produce your own damn movie, sell your own damn movie. I think they're still very pertinent. But the idea was, we from the beginning, was to create a little brand. Like one of the few things I learned at Yale was, other than drugs and my major, was comic books. I didn't read them. I never read them.
Hmm.
Oliver Stone had Scrooge McDuck. I remember that. And my folks didn't really permit, or did, you know, we never had them. We didn't have Coca-Cola either. But ingested this, I don't know how to exactly describe it, but the idea of building a brand. And I searched out, because I had, the guy next door to me at Yale had a big collection of Marvel comics, and I had never seen them. Spider-Man, my God, look how beautiful. This is 1964, 65,
right.
66, and the beauty of it. And I love all the alliteration, he'd give the names to Steve Ditko, sexy Steve Ditko, he'd give him a credit, or
right,
the
right.
penciler, penciler, what's that? I didn't
yeah.
even know.
Pencils
but,
and inks
but
and
I was,
colors.
I was, so when the minute I got out of school, I searched out Stan Lee and
well, you wrote with Stan, right?
Yeah. Well, eventually, he in those days, he wasn't really Stan Lee. He was working at a company called Magazine Management, which produced Marvel Comics in New York City. And I think it was, in New York City. He lived in New York, not far from my house. And we hit it off. And he gave me a quarter-inch tape with an idea he had for a movie. And I had a quarter-inch tape recorder, and I listened to it. And I wrote The Night of the Witch, and it got immediately optioned right away by the company for which I was sweating, named Canon.
Oh, yes.
And it was before the boys from Tiberius.
Before Golan and Globus.
Yeah, before them. And John G. Avildsen's where I met him. He was working there.
But the film never got made?
No, it never got made. I had it. I actually, years later, I had money for it, like $2 million from Scandinavia. Stan was wild up. He was all excited. It would have been Stan Lee's Night of the Witch, directed by Lloyd Kaufman. And we had meetings with the guys from Finland, with the money guys. They came in to meet with him here, and it looked like it was going to happen. And then came the big lunch with Stan and his partner and me in Pow Productions guy. They're a very nice guy.
Mm-hmm.
But we had lunch, and I was thinking, okay, this is great. We're going to do this. And make history, right? A big buzz, right?
Yeah.
Stan Lee and Lloyd Kaufman. And because Stan was the one who got Toxic Avenger into Marvel, right? The comic
books.
Right? Yeah, it was only because of him. Because they only, for the most part, Marvel only does things they own, franchises
original
they own.
Stuff,
Toxic
yeah.
Avenger, they didn't own. They just licensed it for the comic books.
Right.
And they licensed Toxic Crusaders, and that was thanks to Stan. And I wrote The Night of the Witch, so I got these guys from Finland, and it would still be low budget by Hollywood mainstream standards. And
$2 million is not that bad.
Well, for us, it'd be
the
biggest budget I've ever done was Kabuki Man, which was $1 million
in
1989. Now the hashtag Shakespeare Shitstorm was not even $500,000. It was like 400 and something.
Wow.
So it gets, that's because we get everybody, fans are on our movies, so they work for very little.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the good people from here come to work for us because they can experiment and have some fun.
You shoot everything in New York and New Jersey and the environs, right?
Well, we shot part of hashtag Shakespeare Shitstorm in Albania. We're the first American movie company to come film in Albania.
Wow.
And they did a great job, and we got great value, and they even did some very good CGI for us. And based on that, Fangoria has just made the remake of Castle Freak.
In Albania,
the whole thing, and for a budget 10 times what I think we are, with star, they had stars, and I don't know what the budget was.
We love Fangoria.
It seemed like a big deal. Yeah,
that's great.
But based on the fact that we did it and got successful, and that was Albania's gamble. They want to be like Romania, but with the movies, Romania's got this flourishing movie theater, a movie studio
movie market,
world,
yeah,
and Bulgaria too, and
they're very competitive now.
Yeah,
and
so Albania wants part of that action, and they figured if they give us a good deal, most of the American producers are chicken shit. They don't want to be first, God forbid, or because they might get fired, they might might lose their job wearing a suit and tie. Although I am wearing a suit and tie. So.
There you go.
But they can't.
It's jeans too.
Only my wife could fire me.
So,
I've come close too.
You were raised in a rather repressive household then? You went
to
Catholic
very.
School?
My folks were like jet set.
They
were wild. They're much wilder than they and they got divorced, of course.
But you said there was no Coca-Cola, there were no...
Yeah, they were kind of,
strict.
Swiss French governess as a kid and learned French at home. And
you had a privileged growing up.
Oh, bourgeois to the extreme.
Your dad do?
He was, he created the stockholder lawsuit, basically. His entire career was based on Section 16B of the Securities and Exchange Commission, which I put in a lyric... The poultry guy, Snyder of the Chicken Dead.
Oh, there we go.
Yeah, it's actually, there's a lot of stuff going on in trauma movies. And, a lot of the gatekeepers, they don't really watch our movies.
Right.
And if they did, they the Museum of Modern Art obviously did because they premiered. And what they did with the Return to Newcomb High, which they premiered it with in a series called The Contenders, which is their 13 movie series, annual series, with what they consider the most important movies from around the world.
Wow.
Woody Allen, Coen Brothers, Scorsese, Sofia Coppola,
Kaufman.
The French, yeah, and there I was. And the curator, when he introduced me, he said this could be his last day of employment with the Museum of Modern Art. But the security guys told me they had the biggest turnaway ever for Return to Newcomb High Volume 1 because the people want to see trauma movies, but they can't get them.
It's hard
they want to see them on a big screen,
and
it's hard to get. If I direct a movie, I can get some theaters, but I mean, we have young directors who are terrific, and the theaters don't want to hear about it. Nobody returns our calls.
Well, the competition is between those movies and the $200 million Marvel theme park.
Yeah, and unfortunately, a lot of the so-called independent theater chains are owned by kind of mini conglomerates, and they're living off of the vassals of the majors. Fox Searchlight, that's what's considered independent,
or Sony Classics.
They're good movies.
Yeah.
They're excellent movies. They're not going to change the world the way the Toxic Avenger or Terra Firma is doing, but they are certainly entertaining and brilliant movies by talented people and, in many cases, very worthy.
If you had a blank check, what would you make?
I would stick to my... I might add, instead of $500,000, I might ask for another $500,000 to get better actor and better, maybe get better writing. But if I had that, that huge budget, I'd have 100 people making $500,000 movies, And
is there a dream movie that you have yet to make that you really are dying to tackle?
If I had to, oh, that's a good question. Yeah, it would be Pal Joey, my favorite musical. It's very dark. It's based on a John O'Hara short story, and that's terrific. And they've made a bad movie when they made it.
Very
it's
Hollywood
terrible.
Musical.
It's horrible. It's they made every mistake possible, and in spite of the most brilliant satire and witty songs, and but it is dark, and they should have kept it. It would, you know, but I don't think the Richard Rodgers and Lorenz Hart estate is going to be interested in a Lloyd Kaufman version of Pal Joey, but it's got everything trauma in it. I mean, it's terrific.
Well, tell me about your first experience with an audience when you made your first movie and it played in the cinema, and you were there in the back row, I'm guessing. Tell me what that experience was like.
I made a 16 millimeter movie in when I was in Yale, feature length. Well, it was 70 something minutes, which for you film students out there, here's a secret for you. If you make a 72 minute movie that's really boring and that it's in black and white with no sync sound, it seems like it's a 90 minute movie. In fact, so there's a way to save money. I learned with that movie. The Yale Film Society premiered it and charged $1, and it went around to Ivy League colleges and a few others. And I learned that is, no matter how bad the movie is, the audiences don't usually they don't ask for their money back. So that was very valuable. Mm-hmm. And I also learned they put a The Girl Who Returned is it couldn't be it's G rated. It's kind of about an Olympics. Men and women live in different parts of the world, and every 4 years they have Olympic Games. And there's the protagonist in my movie was a young woman with very large love pillows, and she was a jogger. You know, she was a long distance runner, and there was a shot where she's flopped on the ground, facing upright, sweaty, and but the T-shirt she was wearing made her look kind of sexy. And by accident, I shot a still that looked pretty sexy. So that was the poster, The Girl Who Returned. and they put that up around campus. And the same night, they were playing, I think it was Moonrise by Borzage.
Right.
And, you know, like three people showed up. All they did was Moonrise by Frank Borzage. And that was
right,
it. You know,
right.
Just a basically yellow and black poster. But The Girl Who Returned was packed.
There
so
you
that
go.
Was very valuable lesson.
So that was
and Borzage's movie, which is that's a masterpiece, Borzage's movie.
Yeah.
Is it called Moonrise? Was I right?
I think you're right.
Yeah, I think it's Moonrise. Yeah. So that was too valuable.
Well, what was...
But the idea of an audience. Michael Herz and I, we are still amazed that people will buy a ticket to see something. I'm 73 years old. It's still a miracle to see people lining up or buying something that we made. I mean, it's incredible.
Tell me the first really great experience, the one that was like, oh, man, am I glad I chose this.
There has never been that particular moment.
Surely there's it's been always, a screening or you've gone to a movie on 42nd Street or whatever that one of your movies had played where the audience roars. They
yes,
have a great
there's
time.
A lot of that. But,
and certainly at
the film festivals. And, you know, our fans, the Troma fans, are rabid.
But I
they
mean the beginning.
Terrific.
When you're a young filmmaker starting out, first, second, third movie, you go in there and you see an audience transfixed by what you did.
I've never really, until recently, when the fact that we have 30-year-old movies that fill up a house in a faraway state, you know, where I've never been and has never played a Troma movie ever, you know, like Montana, and I go out there and they're packed. That's pretty exciting. But or the fact that hashtag Shakespeare Shitstorm, everybody in that, we have thousands of people in that movie. Almost all of them were fans. Many of them worked as background people for a hot dog. You know, we didn't even get a hot lunch. And the DP is a Hollywood guy. The effects did big movies here, Jurassic Park, and they were fans.
They do it out of love.
They really, and they get to experiment. They get to, you know, and they can move up the food chain. You know, the guy who was operating the camera can now be the DP, you know, that kind of stuff. The same way that we've introduced tons of famous, everybody from Samuel Jackson to Fergie
to James Gunn.
Yeah, James Gunn, Eli Roth, Oliver Stone. He'd be writing shitty novels if he was watching me make movies at Yale, and it turned out he's a movie genius. He got in because of me. He's in the first movie I ever had in a real theater, Battle of Love's Return. Lynn Lowry, who you probably know, that's her first movie. And there were some Warhol people, but Oliver's in it briefly.
She was in Shivers and Cat People.
Yes, she was. And, of course, Romero's movie, which was named...
The one with several titles.
Codename Trixie was the second name.
Jack's Wife.
Before, the original title was The Crazies.
Right, The Crazies.
And the theaters wouldn't take it because crazy was too much, right? We were involved in making a movie that Tarantino just showed before he showed it at the New Beverly, called Sweet Savior, where Troy Donahue plays it plays Charles Manson character. It isn't about Manson, but it's clearly inspired by that, and it was made then.
So bill that with Once Upon a Time in
Hollywood. Well, he did that. Yeah. He had a print
His
of it.
His theater obviously. Is so great.
He had a print of it, yeah. So the theaters wouldn't take the title Sweet Savior because it's got a religious thing. Mm. I mean, it was a different world. So I can't remember what they changed it to, but it took the wind out of it.
So who are your heroes?
My heroes, I would say, are the great, in terms of movie.
Let's talk movies.
Oh, the great directors by far. Stan Brakhage is my opinion, the greatest, other than Mick Garris, maybe the greatest.
Right,
Stan Brakhage, the greatest visual artist of my lifetime.
Very expressionistic.
Yeah, and we brought him to Yale too. We brought him there, and I did an interview with him on the radio station. Hmm. I interviewed him, Lillian Gish, and Montgomery Clift. With whom I probably could have had a blowjob. But he definitely was very interested in my belt, which looked like this, just a plain old belt. But nice guy. He lived next door to us in New York, and one night he got drunk and rang our doorbell. He could see me in my bedroom at my mother's home, and he came around the front and rang the bell, and I had the reel-to-reel tape recorder, so I interviewed him. My father said, "Hey, you're trying to do the radio. Why don't you interview this guy?" I knew nothing. I knew absolutely nothing. I was like, I thought these questions were really stupid. But nice guy. He was a really nice guy. But I didn't make it on the radio station because I had a big mouth. And and the Stan Brakhage thing. Stan Brakhage, it was an hour. And I asked him one question, and he spoke for an hour. But what he said was so brilliant. But the little boys wanted to hear the Supremes or some shit, you know. I mean, I like the Supremes, but,
of course,
you know, here's Stan Brakhage.
Yeah.
Then we showed Art of Vision, and just hearing him talk about it, much less watching it.
What about the narrative filmmakers? Who are your favorites?
Chaplin, Keaton, John Ford, Howard Hawks, Sam Fuller, Jean Renoir.
Modern?
Well, Takashi Miike, he was a big fan. I met him when he was a teenager, and he was a big fan. But
he did one of our Masters of Horror.
Yes, and it was a good. It might be the best one. I mean, they're all great, but his was. He's amazing, unbelievable.
Yeah,
he made a samurai movie for TV with no fighting, no samurai, and it's riveting. You can't take your eyes off it. It's beautiful to look at. He did a movie called Happiness of the Katakuras, in which people are singing and dancing, and it's got suicide, but there's people singing and dancing, which gave me the courage to make Poultrygeist into a musical.
Because
it was a big ambition of mine was to have singing and dancing. I do have, every movie I've made pretty much has at least one song or two sung on screen. And
you have the heart of a music lover. Yes.
I do, or at least of the musical, of the great musicals.
Musical lover.
I do love musicals.
Well, let's get back to the business of today.
Yes.
Has it become much more difficult to find funding to make a film these days?
Well, if you tell the truth, it's impossible. What am I going to tell people? I just spent 5 years making a two-volume movie, probably my best work, and we won't make a penny. Would you like to invest? I can't. I can't tell people that. There's no way I can ask for investors. So the investors who come in, they just fans. They know they're going to lose their money, and they and we don't get many investors.
So it's like crowdfunding in a lot of sources.
No, very little. We did it once. Okay. We did crowdfunding twice, and I don't want to do it again because our fans are very poor, and they shouldn't be doing that. They should not. They should be paying their student loans and not fucking around with financing trauma movies. And we were successful both times, but also we in fact. We did do some of Return to Nukem High, a.k.a. Volume 2. We were really broke, and we either the movie sits for 2 or 3 months, or we do Kickstarter, and our fans came through with $80,000, I think.
Wow.
It was. But we still haven't sent them the premiums because the thing has been going theatrical. The Blu-ray has just been finished, and this has got to be 5 years.
Wow.
Well, art is not, it's not instant coffee.
No, and it's a very different world.
I take a long time. People think, oh, you have so much fun and, you whip this stuff together. Not at all. We do distribute movies where the younger people are much more agile with the digital format and they're fast and they're good. Right. But I can't, it takes me a long time.
How do you see the future of trauma?
I honestly don't know. I think the movies will take on, some of them already have a life of their own. I honestly don't know. I don't know. We have about 15 movies that are the main ones that bring in revenue. We have a huge library. We've had offers to sell it, but I was buddies with Sam Arkoff, Samuel Z. Arkoff.
Yeah.
And he told me the biggest regret he ever had was selling American International Pictures Filmways, I think.
Right, Viacom. Became Filmways.
And all his stuff got dispersed, and the brand was destroyed.
Well, you talk about having so much regret. What is your biggest regret?
I think the biggest regret is my mouth.
There's
no reason for me to have mouthed off so much against Sundance or Cannes Film Festival or the MPAA or... Rupert Murdoch, I became chairman of the Independent Film and Television Alliance, who most of whom are living off the crumbs that fall off Rupert Murdoch's table. And when I was elected, I got the treasurer of our trade association to produce a cartoon rap song starring Rupert Murdoch. It was very funny too, and where he's dancing around, doing rap, but very clever lyrics. I got one of the trauma animators to do it for virtually nothing.
Yeah.
And the board was incensed. You were insulting Rupert Murdoch. They were upset.
Oh dear.
Yeah, it was like 2004.
You must love Succession.
So, yes. But the point is that it's I don't think you could start a trauma today. As I mentioned, Stan Lee's universe, that was the Marvel universe is we're like an underground Marvel universe. We have our characters, we have we make our own movies, we own our building, we got a big library, we don't have any debt.
Yeah.
We're kind of able to keep going. We have even today there's a fair amount of Toxic Avenger merchandise that's out there being sold, and it's actually had a little comeback. And we just got our first Bloodsucking Freaks licensing.
I don't
remember what the product was, but it was something like gloves.
There's a world of Bloodsucking Freaks product potentials out there.
Well, I don't know. It's the first one. It's been a long time.
So what would you say is your greatest accomplishment?
Well, I think the thing I'm most proud of is I've had the same wife for 45 years,
yeah.
And I've had the same partner for 45 years in my business, that's a pretty good thing.
That's an achievement.
Not too many people can say that.
Yeah, that's
not
for
in this
sure.
business.
That's for sure.
Especially the wife part. But I guess just the idea that we've been, I don't think there's been an independent movie studio that has been in that's left such a footprint on the countryside of the art. I mean,
with a single ownership.
Yes, continuous same management for 45 years. You look at the people who've come out of our company. You look at the influence. I mean, the Deadpool guys, I never met them. But, they talk about Toxic Avenger. In fact, Legendary is remaking the Toxic Avenger with a out-of-the-box, a very interesting guy named Macon Blair. Terrific. He's only made one movie himself, but he's written Green Room and Blue Rising, is it called?
Oh, no.
Murder Party and Blue Something.
I know
terrific.
Which one you mean. Yeah.
And he lives in Austin, and he's obsessed with Troma. And he wrote the script for them, and I've read it, and it's better than the original Toxic Avenger, but it hews to the spirit of Troma. And, you know, they'll make it R-rated. It won't be graphic, but why not? It's going to be great. It's very entertaining. And I think it's...
Troma goes mainstream.
If they let him direct it, it's going to be good. That's all I care about. You know, if it's good and entertaining, Terra Firma, a movie nobody showed up for in 1999, we couldn't get it in anywhere. It's flying. Blu-rays, you can't imagine. It's suddenly come to life.
So physical media still works for you.
Oh, shit. Yeah. Yeah, a lot. Because nobody, the word of mouth. It's all
because
word of mouth.
Because there's no other way to get.
Well, the theatrical, when Return to Nukem High Volume 1 came out, we had maybe 200 theaters. Most of them were limited to the weekend, like your nightmare cinema.
Yeah.
But we had 2 weeks in L.A., and we had 2 weeks in New York. And it kind of pushes us up a little more. You know, L.A. Times gave it a pretty good review. Yeah. And New York Times gave it a review I'll never forget. And fuckers. This shit.
Those are the ones that are hard
to
forget. That's
the thing
right?
That I'm bitter about. I mean, come on. Give me a break. We had animated. We had credits that an artist did that were beautiful. And they were 3D animated. We had singing and dancing. There were things in that movie that just the fact that we're Troma's 45 years, he says a would-be studio. You know, he couldn't say anything, nothing about the fact that all, you know, it's kind of legendary. And, you know, Vincent Canby, the other critics of the Times, they always say, and we're New York. And this guy just killed us. Meanwhile, the Museum of Moving Image and Museum of Modern Art are highlighting it. So, but the point is, it gives us, to be in the theaters, it gives us a little bit of cachet. And the movies in my head are made for the theaters. There's tons of little details in our movies. You call it shtick. But while the protagonists of the film are on screen doing whatever it is, there are people in the background doing also. We have a guy in Joe Lynch. You know him.
Oh, I know
Joe. He directed
Joe.
For you, I think, right?
Didn't
he?
Not for me,
But anyway, he's very successful now.
Yep.
He played a background character in he was on the crew, but he played a background character in Terra Firma, Clothespin Boy. And he would have clothespins, but and you'd see him in the background doing absolutely ridiculous stuff.
Yeah.
But he says people, you know,
recognize
when he goes to
him,
conventions.
Yeah,
yeah, clothespin boy, you know, in addition to his successful movies.
Yeah. Well, Lloyd, revenge is sweet. And I can't tell you how much I appreciate you joining us for Postmortem.
Well, hashtag Shakespeare's Shitstorm is about brutal revenge. The Tempest was, Prospero wanted the brutal revenge, but I don't want any revenge. I'm like you. Yeah. I've got a good run. I've been so fucking lucky. You know, wife, partner, I've been able to make movies for 50 years that I've had fun. You know, I can't say fun, but I've had fun seeing them out, you know, because they're good. They're good movies.
You get to do what you love to do.
I got to do what I love to do. You know, this is interesting. James Gunn, I guess we're running out of time, but we run Troma Dance for 20 years.
Right, your version of Sundance.
Well, we did it at Sundance for 10 years, but now it's kind of a real festival, and we do it in New York. But he was on the panel 1 year, and he was telling people, you know, you should do what you're good at. And I say, no, you do what you want to do. But if I was doing what I was good at, I probably would be. I was in George Bush's class at Yale, and I bet you I would have been where he is. I was really good at
President
politicking.
Kaufman.
Yeah, and he could have, based on his administration, I think could have
run Troma.
Very very good Troma movies. Come on, the world he'd lived in. Oh my God, the ideas he had. You couldn't think those. You couldn't write that stuff. Think some of the things he said.
Aye.
Of course, you got a guy now who's going to go on the circuit.
Makes George look brilliant.
Oh, well, also, he's funny as fuck at Trump. The press, those rallies he has, they're hilarious. He's got a great career if he's not in jail.
Hoping for the latter. Yeah, anyway.
Anyway, you're the
thank
best.
You, Lloyd.
Thank you,
thank
Mick.
You.
Thank you
great
so much.
Great to spend some time with you. Just so you know, Troma has a streaming channel. It's watch.troma.com, and you can subscribe to it. It's $5 a month, and you get a free one-month trial to check it out. You can also watch 250 free movies on Troma's YouTube channel, youtube.com/user/Troma Movies. And their latest feature, Return to Newcomb High Volume 2, is coming soon. If you're enjoying the podcast, we'd really appreciate it if you would let the world know about it by reviewing and rating it on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. If you have comments or questions for our Ask Mick Anything shows, send them to producer Joe at Joe Russo Tweets or to at Mick Garris PM on Instagram or Twitter or the Postmortem with Mick Garris Facebook page. This is a brand new address, so don't forget it. That's at Mick Garris PM on both Twitter and Instagram. And if you'd like to see my vintage and recent video interviews, making of documentaries, and audiobooks of some of my short stories, go to my website, mickgarrisinterviews.com.
Thanks for listening to Postmortem with Mick Garris. Download new episodes every other Wednesday and subscribe on iTunes.